We are working through the book of Acts, and the repeated theme phrase I want to use so that you know you can remember at least one thing from like these 20-30 weeks, and it's witnesses to the ends of the earth. Witnesses to the ends of the earth, right? I don't really quite get this, but do you notice that like identity and purpose have become like huge themes? Every movie, every book, like who am I? What is my purpose, right? The thing I don't really get is why it's so cryptic when God is unusually clear, right? And he has said very simply, you are my witnesses, right, to the ends of the earth. And so one of the like setup questions I should have posed when we first began this series is to ask you to consider, what is your ends of the earth? That is, right, I, being a pastor and a seminary professor, will never be in a law firm. I will never be inside, you know, like Booz Allen, the consulting, you know, firm. I won't be like basically where you are. And so, to be honest, there's no way I can like reach that end of the earth, right? Whereas you are uniquely situated wherever you are to minister to a certain type of people. Some of you, for instance, let's say you own like a business, and so you have colleagues, right? And so as we think about this series, right, I just want you to consider not something necessarily grand, that's not a good starting place, but just to ask yourself, where has God sovereignly placed you right now, like, to be a witness to? You see, I just want to make it very real. And then to just invite you to ask this question, are you being a witness of the resurrected Lord to them? Really simple, okay? And so, and one of the things that's really big at New City is we try to, in one sense, like explode like grand notions of the Christian life. Like if you're really serious about the faith, then you have to go to seminary, you have to become like a pastor or missionary, and then, and only then can you do grand things. No, not at all. I just want to encourage you just to ask this basic question. Where are you right now, literally, in terms of work and life? And then who are the people there? Who are your neighbors? And then to ask this very simple question, are you fulfilling your calling to witness to them? And so that's something I want to ask you to think about. Now today, I'm going to really focus on just one main idea, and it's the kind of witness or the kind of approach that we are to take as witnesses. And so that's all I want to think about today, because it's so instructive. When you look at chapter 2, and you ask this question, what can I learn from Peter's approach to being an effective witness? I think there's a lot to be said there, okay? And so that's the one thing. As you think about your specific context, right, you know, what can we learn about Peter from his approach, okay? So 3 points, related points. Number one, Peter's approach. That's number one, Peter's approach. Number two, the response, right? And then finally, number three, the fruit. It's really simple. What's his approach? What's the response? And what's the fruit? So let's get started. So Peter, he gets, keep this in mind, he's a Jew. And if you look at this text carefully, Luke goes out of his way to highlight that he's addressing fellow Jews, right? Fellow Jews, right? And this, if you're too familiar with the Bible, just you might gloss over, but do you notice that when he speaks to the Jews, right, he uses sources, and you might say material, that would have been familiar to the Jews and would have had weight. And so, like, for instance, like, let's say you're a preacher in New York City, right? You're probably going to read the New Yorker, the Wall Street Journal, because those resources have credibility. And so when Peter begins to speak to the crowds, right, he begins with where they are, and he goes, okay, I know you all know Jesus of Nazareth, right? You all know Jesus of Nazareth. So he begins with where they are, and then he makes this outrageous claim that this wasn't just an ordinary man. He was the Son of God. He came, he lived, he performed miracles, he died, but he was raised to life, and now is ascended, you know, like at the right hand of God the Father. But notice what he does. He begins where they are, and then when he speaks to them again, he uses sources that they would have been very familiar with, right? And, you know, this seems like basic, but Most of the times we don't do this. It was like years ago. It was about, I think it was like 10 years ago. I had made a big shift in life and ministry. So during that time, I had basically left the Korean American Church. And my main context was working with, you know, adults like you all, right? Educated adults. And I was a seminary professor, you know, and still am. So that's my usual context. But I got invited to speak at this youth retreat at a Korean church, okay? It was so foreign to me. I mean, it had been years. And so here I am, and it's a context where, you know, many of them actually are bilingual, right? And so they asked me to be the speaker, and I said to the pastor, this is a mistake, okay? Like, you don't want me, and because I just didn't get them, and they didn't get me. So I came up the first message, and I preached, and, you know, nothing. And no response, and, you know, just totally, you know, no one was connecting. And then that happened for another message. And finally, I'm not sure my wife remembers this, but she made a suggestion. She said, you know what, like, Paul, you know how you've been watching Korean drama? And I said, how do you know? But I was watching this Korean drama. And by the way, if you've never seen a Korean drama, don't worry. They're all the same. You know, like, they really are. Just two guys who are, like, best friends. And then they fall in love with this one girl who, like, is, like, the exception to the doctrine of sin. And she's always dying. Okay? Just, like, she's always dying. And then basically, one of the guys does something like outrageous, right? And then dies so that she can live. And it's always the same narrative, but it works, right? So anyway, you know, she suggested, why don't you like talk about like this drama a little and try to explain the gospel in that way? And I was like, you know, I'm the seminary professor. I know how to do this. She said, just try it, right? I was like, all right, fine. So it was the last evening. I said, all right, guys. And again, they got used to not listening to me. I wasn't listening to them. I said, and I think the name of the drama was like some ridiculous title, like Stairway to Heaven. So let me talk to you about Stairway to Heaven. All of a sudden, it's like the Spirit came. They are giving me their undivided attention, right? And I say, this is what the gospel is like. This, it was so ridiculous. I said, remember that guy in the story where basically the girl he loves is like going blind? And so he decides to like sacrifice himself so that he can give her his eyes, which I don't even think is medically possible. And then the next scene, like, you know, she can see, and it came at the cost of, you know, his life, right? And I said, that's the gospel. That night, there was mass conversion. All of a sudden, it made sense. And they were like, oh my gosh, like, that's the gospel. And I was like, oh man. That's all it took, right? Because what I was doing was I wasn't starting where I was, but I was starting where they were. And I went into the world, into their worldview, and began to try to explain the gospel from that perspective. And by the way, when you look at the Old Testament and the New Testament, this has always been God's approach. This is why, do you notice in Jesus' ministry, Jesus was the most brilliant man that ever lived. And yet the crowds understood him. Why? Because he had entered their worldview. He had taken time for 30 years to listen, to learn, to know how they talk, what they think about, and then he was able to minister well. So that is the approach. And I want to invite you, this is why your ministry, your witness, should be in the area that you are most familiar with. You know, your immediate setting, your professional setting, your social setting. And you're called to enter, right, where they are, meet them where they are, and then use, you might say, credible sources, right, so that they might come to believe in the gospel. Now, just one very important application. One very important application is this, right? I'm really struck by this when you read chapter 2. These Jews, right, they don't really have an emotional experience first. It doesn't begin with an emotional experience. It doesn't say they were cut to the heart at the very beginning. Instead, right, this is so important. Peter basically enters their worldview and challenges it. Because you see, Jews, they did not believe people like resurrect in history. They did believe in a final resurrection, but they were not susceptible to believe in this, right? And you see, this is the point I'm making. Conversion always requires, right, a step back and a reconsideration of what you believe. That is, right? While conversion is not primary, it's not only cognitive, but it requires, right, a reset. It requires thinking. It requires like this is how I ought to view reality. And by the way, if you have never actually gone through that, like, you should really ask yourself whether, you know, the gospel has ever intercepted your reality. You see, this is why Luke, again, he began this Acts account by saying, I know this sounds like hocus pocus, like it sounds like fantasy, but I'm coming to you as a physician, and I'm saying this actually happened. You see, and this is what, again, I want to highlight. No matter what your personality type is, no matter what your bent is, right? I say this all the time. Christianity is a thinking man's religion. Like, it's a thinking man's religion. Because at some point in your life, you have to ask this question. Is this true? Not like, does this inspire you, right? But at some point, if you consider yourself a Christian, it means that at some point, you actually went through this struggle of asking, wait, is this actually true? Not does it help me? Does it warm my heart? But is it true that this person that everyone calls Jesus, right? And you hear this all the time, like Jesus, great inspiration. He's a great teacher. He's a great moral exemplar. And that's exactly what Luke is not saying. You notice he says, no, he's the Son of God. It sounds crazy, but it's true. I want to say this to you, right? If you are sitting here, if you're listening in, and you've never really had an honest internal dialogue, right, where you're like, is this true? Like, and that then has a ripple effect on the way you view reality. Conversion is, because again, that's what the point is, where Peter is saying, I'm entering your worldview and I'm telling you this is true. It should explode your worldview and it should change the way you experience reality. So that's number one. Number two, the response, right? Now, here too, we can learn so much, but Luke says they were cut to the heart, meaning this, right? It's not like they learn some trivia fact. You know, like when you watch Jeopardy, you always like learn all these things, right? Like, it's not like that. It's they were cut to the heart, right? Because this is the second part of conversion. It's not just knowledge, but it's not less than knowledge. But it's when it becomes personal knowledge. Do you notice in this sermon, right? Throughout this sermon, Peter keeps saying this, you crucified Jesus. It was your sin that crucified Jesus, right? And if you have never reached this point of like, it's like this, you know, like, have you ever broken like the speed limit? Probably, right? And if you get caught, you're like, ugh, I have to pay a ticket. And so there's that sense of like, there isn't really guilt even though you broke a law, right? Because it's impersonal. It's like, okay, I should have kept, you know, this speed limit. However, when you have betrayed a person, when you have hurt someone, right, that's a different category. Because it's not just that you did something wrong, it's that you hurt somebody. You offended somebody, and your response to that is not merely cognitive, but it's very personal, right? And that's what it means when it says they were cut to the heart. And friends, like, you know, again, I know we all have different temperaments, right? But again, at some point in your life, if you count yourself a Christian, there has to be a sense that, like, my sins, right, are why Jesus died. He died for me. He was raised to life for my salvation, and therefore I do owe him. Therefore, I do love him because he has first loved me. And I'm not saying you always need to be weepy and things like that, but you see, if your like spirituality is just cognitive, if it's just intellectual and it's not transformative where it has pierced your heart, right? That's not the sort of conversion that's in mind. The crowd, when they heard Peter, right, it says that they were like broken and they responded because of their brokenness, right? You see, so eventually I'll talk to you about a triad, but it does begin with knowledge, but then it goes on the existential realm where it's got to hit you deep within, right? And just a few quick reflections here. You know, we don't really get asked this question that much anymore, but sometimes people ask, like, do you believe in miracles? Many of you know this. What's my response? Absolutely. I absolutely believe in miracles because the greatest miracle is when a person's heart is cut and changed. It's not like, hey, I had this disease, I'm healed. Well, that can be miraculous. The greatest miracle is when people are cut to the heart and they respond to with faith to Jesus Christ, right? However, what I do want to highlight with this sermon was, so therefore, was their conversion a spiritual work? Was it God's providence? Yes. But the ordinary means that God used, right, was what I call incarnational communication. You see, had basically Peter spoken in a way, in a language that would not have been intelligible to a crowd, then would their hearts have been cut? No. And again, this is a great example of how divine sovereignty, human responsibility, they come together, where part of the reason why they were cut to the heart was because of the approach that Peter took. Was it God? Yes. Was it also Peter's approach? Yes, right? But again, conversion comes, right, by the sovereignty of God, when the people of God, right, communicate in a way that's intelligible. Second quick application I want to give is this. Sometimes this gets lost in the text, but I think this is fascinating. So there's this book written by a Harvard sociologist. It's called The Weirdest People on Earth. And he's agnostic, the author, but he has some really interesting comments. Now, you know, when you look at this text, it's interesting. You look at Pentecost, right? I hope this fascinates you, but there's actually a very good application there. It says like thousands were converted. Now, because we are a Western society, this is how we read this text. We think, oh, 3,000 individuals were converted. We almost think of this like a Billy Graham, like, you know, crusade, where like 3,000 people came forward to give their life to Jesus. So when you read an account like this. But the author of this book, The Weirdest People on Earth, right, he has an interesting observation that it's so obvious when you think about it after. But he says, you see, when we read about all these revival accounts, it's not necessarily like 3,000 people came forward and gave their life to Jesus, right? He says it's because back then we were more communal. So like when the leaders of a village converted, the entire village converted because there wasn't like multiple beliefs, right? And what's going on here, right, is I think Luke is saying something very insightful. When you look at this promise where repent and you will be saved, he's talking particularly, if you look at the language where he keeps saying brothers, he's saying this. And by the way, I know this is super unpopular to say, but he's basically saying that as the men were converted, right, the families were converted. See, it's a very interesting read. It's not just, hey, 3,000 individuals came. The language of household imagery, believe and you and your household will be saved, right? What he's getting at here is that the men, in large part, were converted, right? And because of their faith, right? And the parents, but particularly the men, right? He's addressing the brothers, right? Families came to Christ. Now, this is a difficult topic to address because there are so many intersecting questions to ask. Like, oh, does that mean that, you know, like women are unthinking? No, obviously not. Does this mean that, you know, in the end, each person doesn't have to profess his faith? No, I'm not discounting that. I don't want to be reductionistic and simplistic, but I don't want to lose a really valuable application point. And it's this, right? Regardless of like how society changes and whatever philosophy is out there, right? Again, you know, I say always read memoirs. It's this, how the men, right, particularly in the context of a family, how they go, it's not determinative, but boy, is it influential. You see, does everyone see that balance? I'm not saying that if your husband and your father isn't a believer, I'm not saying that if he wasn't, you have no chance. You know, like, I think that's, like, the Bible's not simplistic in that sense. But one of the main ideas in the Bible is this thing called federal headship or things like that. And this is what it's basically saying. And I want to address specifically the men and those of you that are married, right? This is, again, a good example where, yes, salvation belongs to the Lord. And yes, I'm not saying that it only and entirely depends on the man and the family. I'm not saying it's determinative, right? But from the very beginning of the Bible and to the end, and this is true for almost every memoir you read, right? The man in the household, right? You have like a weight of responsibility that cannot be overlooked. And when you look at this text and it says, many came to know the Lord, it's because the men led their wives and led their children to faith. You see? And again, I'm not being sexist and none of that. I'm just saying the testimony of the Bible, to be honest, the longer you live, I think you know that there is at least some grain of truth here, right? Men, however you go, and you know, if you're like, I don't want to take my calling, whatever, seriously, I'm not saying it determines your family's outcome, but man, it is going to leave such a long-term impact. And I hope that that would just hit home. I really do. I could just go on about this, but, you know, basically, are you like leading your household? And I know because I'm married, I have children, it's hard. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's complicated. But the basic question is, are you doing that? You can't overlook that part of this text. It's a fascinating application. But it leads us to our last point, the fruit. Now, this is the famous section where it talks about all of a sudden there's mass conversion and they were doing life together. Look at how often that adverb occurs. They were doing life together, right? But, you know, for the sake of time, I just want to make one observation here. One observation. First, if we have to describe this situation, it's basically the anti-COVID situation. So there's a debate in the exciting subculture of the evangelical world, and it goes like this. Should we continue to stream? I don't know where you stand when it comes to that. Our session is like, no, we're not going to in the long run. And many of my good friends who are pastors and, you know, even theologians, they have a different opinion on this, right? And so I might be too old school, but it's really hard to look at a passage like this and to look at the Old and New Testament and to think that prolonged absence together is meant to be the norm. You see, when you look at this text, right, what is clear? They're in person, they're going to the temple, that is, they're worshiping together, they're having people over, and they're eating together, right? And so when you look at the trajectory of the Bible, I think it's really clear that we were meant to be together. We were meant to do life together. And so this is why, to be honest, our session, we don't plan to do streaming forever. We don't. We just don't think that that is the portrait that we're given here. But this is the main observation I want to make here. So we're told at the end of chapter 2, God kept adding to their numbers. So again, there's like revival. This church is growing. God is doing amazing, extraordinary things, right? And so like there are so many books like on church growth, church planting, yada, yada, yada. And so like everyone is looking for the secret. How do you succeed in ministry? How can you make sure that your church continues to explode, right? Like what can you do, right? I think I'm struck by this. Luke says, well, this extraordinary thing of church growth happens actually when church members do two ordinary things. What are we told right at the very end? They would regularly meet to worship together. And when they met together, they took the preach word very seriously. And then they would regularly open their homes and invite one another to like have meals. You're like, no, for real. What's the real secret? And Luke says, okay, they would regularly get together for church. They would worship and take the preach word very seriously. And their homes, right, became a place where they would invite people that were different from them over and they would regularly have meals together. And Luke says, and the Lord added to their number. In other words, God did the extraordinary thing when his people were not making these grand plans, like, okay, we need to take over Rome. You know, no, it wasn't like that. No, it was just like, okay, because of Jesus, we're one, and so we should get together and regularly worship the one who has saved us, have worship, and then we should eat together and be a family. That was the master plan. And because of that, lives were changed and countless were added. I want to end by just giving you like this really simple, hopefully very practical instruction, right? To give people as much benefit of doubt, COVID threw a wrench in everything, duh. But I want to encourage you in two ways, right? Number one is this. There's renew that practice of regularly coming to church to worship together. That's it. That's what the early church did. They regularly met. And I think that there is something to be said where you are very intentional about not missing Sundays. And this is why it's always been a core value, right? And so that's number one, like no more streaming. And session is really clear. When the vaccine becomes available to all, streaming go bye-bye. Okay, so we are really clear about this. We are not keeping it. And, you know, and I get asked this question, how about all the people? Like, when they travel, what are they going to do? My answer is go to church. Okay, like, go to a local church, you know, and worship, right? But the second thing is this, and I really want to say this pastorally, but I want to just really challenge this, right? I think when New City first began, we were actually pretty good about regularly inviting people over just to have meals, right? Let me ask you, like, when is the last time you've had, like, someone over for a meal? And by the way, it doesn't have to be grand, just like coffee, tea. Like, you see, when is the last time you've done that? And I want to just press this on you. Life is so short. We're called to be witnesses to the Lord Jesus. And so when you hear that, you're like, oh man, like, what does this mean? Like, how do I do it? Jesus is saying, just go to church and make it a habit. I think this is very doable. Once a month, have at least two couples over, two singles over. Just, that's it. Try that. And I want to just, this I believe with all my heart, as we as a church continue to do the ordinary, let's see what God does in his sovereignty and mercy. But let's at least do the things that God has called us to do for the sake of the gospel going to the ends of the earth. Okay? Let's pray together. Let's pray.